You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
I'm going to cover some myths and misconceptions about stretching, of which there are a lot, and I'm going to get around to talking about the evidence that shows that these things are myths, or at least that they're truth claims that are not well supported by evidence. But in between there, I'm going to talk about some basic mechanics, because in order for you to understand what the complications are that prevent us from getting good evidence on the subject of stretching, you have to understand some of the mechanical complications. So we'll be doing a little basic mechanics, maybe half of mechanical engineering's program in 45 minutes. So it won't be too difficult. I'm sure you can follow me along. And then we'll get to the bottom lines, at which I'll offer some of the current dogma or recommendations on stretching, what kind of stretching you should do, when, and so on. So what's with these myths and misconceptions? I know I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about this because of personal experience. I remember I played football for 9 years, 5 at high school, 4 intramural tackle football at university. And on a nice fall afternoon, or sometimes on a rainy fall afternoon, we'd be out on the field stretching, you know, with the legs out in front of us and grabbing our toes. And come on, boys, stretch it out, would say the coach. Come on, stretch, stretch, stretch. And it's not something I particularly enjoyed, I must confess. And I'd be sitting there thinking to myself, why are we doing this? Because the coach says it's good for you. Coach says it prevents injuries. Although when I dislocated my thumb playing football, I thought to myself, I don't think stretching my hamstrings helped that, but I'm not sure anyway. Coach says it prevents injuries. Coach says it makes you a better athlete, so we stretched. And then I came and went to medical school and later studied biomechanics. And the further I got into educating myself about stretching, the more I realized that, in fact, coach's opinion that this is good for performance and good for your health really was based on what I would call oral folklore, that he probably heard from his coach when he was playing, and he or she heard it from their coach when they were playing. And so it goes, handed down over the generations, as it were, this wisdom that stretching is good for you, and there's been precious little science done on it, actually. So, as I said earlier, in order to talk about how it is that we have such a lack of evidence, I want to introduce some of the variables that are involved in stretching, some of the mechanical concepts that are involved in stretching. So the first thing is that when you want to stretch a tissue, you have to apply a force to it. And there are actually different types of forces, and collectively all the different types of forces or bending and twisting forces we can apply we call loads. Loads can be linear, by which I mean we can take something and stretch it in a straight line, or we can take something and compress it straight together, or we can take something else and we can bend it. So that's an angular load as opposed to a linear load. And loads can be complex or simple. So the simple loads we call tension and compression. Tension is another name for when you stretch something, so that's a tensile load. Compression is when you squish something, so that's compressed. And those are the two basics. Then we have ways of combining compressive forces to create bending and twisting forces. Now, when we load things, Isaac Newton told us that they accelerate. That's what happens when you push something. But with due respect to Isaac, who was one of the greats, in order to accelerate, first an object must deform. And it doesn't actually, or the two things happen simultaneously, that it deforms as well as accelerating. That's obvious when I push myself to accelerate myself, and you can see my highly rigid shoulder dent as I push it in. It would be even more obvious if I push myself there, no acceleration involved whatsoever, but lots of deformation. So loads cause deformation as well as acceleration. And this deformation is defined as a change in shape. There are two types of deformation, both named from Latin. Isn't everything from Latin or the Greek, I guess? Elastic deformation is what happens when something changes shape and then it goes back to its original shape when you let go of it. So this elastic band, gee, it's called an elastic band. I wonder why. Rubber is very elastic. This is made of rubber. So I stretch that, let go, it goes back to its original length. I can do this a whole lot of times and it's going to keep going back to its original shape. I could do that with a piece of metal too. I've got a little piece of foam attached to a piece of metal, and metal is elastic. We all know rubber's elastic, but metal's elastic too. If I put the metal over the edge of the table and just push down on it a little bit and let go, boing, it springs. It bounces back to where it came from, and I could keep doing this all day long, and at the end of the day, this thing would return to its original position. That's called elastic deformation. Thing is, if you take any elastic, even the rubber, and you push it or pull it just a little bit harder, you can take it past a certain point that we call the elastic limit or the yield point, and then that material or structure deforms plastically. And plastic deformation means that it's going to stay in whatever shape we put it in, that it remains molded. So again, I can use the piece of metal, and if I pushed it just a little bit and it bounces, that's elastic. But if I push this piece of metal harder, look what happens. It stays bent. And I can do that all day long with this thing. Metal is actually very plastic. Think of it as plastic, you call it metal, but it's plastic in engineering sense, in the sense that I can change its shape and it remains changed. And combinations of those are possible. In fact, when we're going to talk about stretching our tissues, when we stretch them a little bit, we're stretching them elastically, but if we take our tissues past that elastic limit that I was talking about, and they start to deform plastically, there will be a bit of both, elastic and plastic deformation, occurring at the same time. Because we like doing things with math, we draw graphs, and we draw a graph of how much force does it take to stretch an object a certain amount. It's called a load deformation experiment. If you walk down the street to the Department of Engineering, you can see them breaking things all day long. That's what they do for a living. And as they're breaking them, they're measuring how much force it takes to break them. So their experiment is called a load deformation experiment. They apply a load to an object and measure how much it deforms. So I'm going to do a real simple one using this yellow therapy band for starters. We'll start with the yellow. And with apologies to the metric fans in the audience, I'm going to use a 2-pound weight. It's about 1 kilogram. So I would take a segment of this. Say I measured off 30 centimeters of it, and I would hang it carefully if I was doing this experiment properly, and then apply the weight and measure how much it deformed. And we could see that with a 2-pound weight, 30 centimeters of this yellow band deforms about 10 centimeters or so. Now, if I did half as much weight, say 1 pound, it would deform half as much. And we could do that experiment where we could show that this thing would deform 5 centimeters only if I hung it. What that results in is what we call linear elasticity, where if we put twice as much force on something when we're stretching it, it stretches twice as much. Fairly simple formula. And by and large, things follow that pattern, so you create a straight line graph. Twice as much force, twice as much stretch, until you get to the elastic limit. When you get to the elastic limit, it starts to break. And the fibers, say, in a tissue, if you're stretching a muscle or in a ligament, will actually start to tear. If I was strong enough to tear yellow TheraBand, I'm not sure I am, but I could take it and, you know, at some point, whoa, it exploded completely. What was that? We'll get to that in a second. But as soon as this started to break, it broke completely. When it starts to break, we see a little curve in the graph where it takes less force to deform it more. And if it was something that wasn't as brittle as that yellow band, we could then keep stretching it, like, say, this piece of metal, which we can keep bending even after we've started to break it. Because I'm breaking the piece of metal now. On a molecular level, I'm changing the bonds in between the atoms of metal, rearranging them, changing the energy state, changing the piece of metal. If I keep bending it enough and I do that enough, the metal will fatigue and it'll eventually snap or wear down. That's plastic deformation. So on this graph that we call the load deformation curve, what we see initially is this elastic region where when we stretch something, it goes back to normal. And then we get past this elastic limit or yield point that it's called, and any further stretching past that causes damage. So there are some words that I need to define to be able to talk about the health and performance effects of stretching. And they relate to what I was just talking about, load deformation. So we need to have a look at them. There's this concept of stiffness. This is something you hear all the time, too. People come into my office, oh, I've got stiffness in my back, or I've got stiffness in my leg, I've got stiffness here and there. They're not using the word the way I use it, okay? I'm going to use the word stiffness technically. And stiffness means the amount of force required to change the shape of something. How much force is required per unit of deformation? And so that's a very specific concept, and it doesn't mean that you have pain. It doesn't mean that you're inflexible. It means that it takes a lot of force to move your joints. We would measure it as the slope of the curve on the graph. So an object that has a steep load deformation graph is stiff by definition. That's different than range. Range is the concept of how far something can stretch, not how much force it takes to stretch it, but how far it can stretch before it breaks. So we'd measure range in meters or millimeters, how far can something stretch? Or we could do it as percent, which we call strain, how many percent of its original length did it stretch? But that's the extent of deformation. So on the graph, we'd measure it just as the horizontal distance on the graph, not as the slope of the curve. You've got the elastic range, which is how far you can go before it starts to break. And then there's a plastic range, how far it goes while breaking, and the total range of a spring or any elastic and is or any object, really, is how far it will go before it breaks completely. That's what we call range, not stiffness. Now, the typical range of human tissues, for tissues other than muscle, which is an active tissue, and it's a bit special, but our ligaments, our fascia, our tendons, our bones, our cartilage, they don't deform a whole lot before they start to break. The tissues like ligaments and tendons and fascia that are made of what's called collagen can stretch somewhere in the range of about 3 to 5% before they start to break, and a total of somewhere in the 7 to 10% range before they burst asunder in their history. So think about it for a second. If you've got a ligament that's 10 centimeters long, like, say, the ligament on the side of this knee that I have handy here, although it's broken, and that ligament is about 15 centimeters long. That's the medial collateral ligament of the knee. If I was to take the knee like that and stretch it 10% of its original length, if it was a real knee, it would be history. Okay? So our tissues really aren't, they're certainly not like rubber bands, which can double their length before they break. These are very stretchy compared to us. We're not that stretchy. Our muscles can stretch a little bit more than our other tissues. So the range of our muscles can be about double that, but that's not the tendon part of the muscle, that's the brown meaty part of the muscle that can stretch more than the tendinous part, which can only stretch 3 to 5% before it starts to tear. So let's think about that for a second. We've got a muscle like, say, the part of the quadriceps that might be 40 centimeters long. We're talking about a total of maybe 4 centimeters of stretch before it starts to tear. They don't stretch as much as you think. The hamstrings, likewise, just a few centimeters of stretching, and they begin to tear. What we call brittle is what I demonstrated with this rubber band, and that is that when it starts to tear, it tears completely. The best example is glass, probably, and it's defined as the opposite of having a large plastic range if there's no plastic deformation possible, so that when something starts to break, it shatters. That's referred to as brittle. Metal is the opposite of brittle. It's what we call ductile, right? Because I can bend this thing all day long, and it just keeps on ticking, right? The ever-ready bunny of stretching, as it were, as opposed to a piece of glass, which I won't demonstrate here. But a piece of glass bends elastically. As soon as it begins to break, boom, the whole thing goes. Now, human tissues are neither as ductile as metal nor as brittle as glass. They're somewhere in between. All right, well, there's half of mechanical engineering, or at least mechanics of materials, without the math in 10 easy minutes. We just want to introduce another element, though, because so far I haven't talked about time. And what about time? How long should you stretch for? Does it make a difference? Elastics behave instantly. So I've just talked about force and change in shape without talking about how long to apply the force for. And that's because with an elastic band, as soon as you apply the force, it stretches, and as soon as you let go, it goes back to its original position. But not everything is like that. Things that are semi-fluid in their nature, which is certainly true of our tissues, our muscles and ligaments and tendons and bones are all very wet. We're mostly water. Anything that is fluid in its nature has a property that we call viscosity that makes it so that it doesn't change shape instantly. If I took a piece of meat, let's say we went into a meat locker and we hung a fresh animal carcass up on a hook and hung a weight from the bottom of it, we would see the meat in that carcass begin to stretch. Well, if we left and came back an hour later, it would have stretched more. So it doesn't stretch completely right away. It takes time to stretch completely because it responds to the force more slowly than a pure elastic band, which responds instantly. And this internal resistance to flow is really important in terms of understanding how long we should stretch for when we stretch. It's called viscosity. It comes from the Latin word for mistletoe berries, which are sticky and goopy. So you think of sugary stuff like molasses is very viscous. Now, I had a piece of memory foam that someone stole on me, and I couldn't replace it for this morning, but you've all seen ads for beds that have memory foam in them. If you stick your hand in a pillow made of so-called memory foam, which is really just viscoelastic foam, and you take your hand out, you see your handprint, and slowly it comes out of the foam. It remains deformed temporarily and then slowly goes back to normal. I can kind of model that with a little syringe here, though, that I borrowed from my medical clinic. If I try to push it quickly, it fights me more than if I try to pull it slowly. It doesn't take a lot of force. And if I stop pushing on the plunger, it stops. That's different than an elastic. Remember, an elastic, when you stretch it and let go, it goes back to its original position. But what we call a damper, a viscous element, it's called a damper. A damper, when I deform it and let go, it remains deformed. Now, we see this in combination usually, where you combine a viscous damper with an elastic. And probably the most commonplace in terms of things that we see in everyday life are the spring dampers that close doors in schools and shopping malls so they don't slam. If you want a door to close, you have to put a spring on it that makes the door go back to the closed position. But if you just put a spring on it, then every time somebody lets go of the door, it'll slam shut because the spring works instantly. Whereas if you put a damper on it, the spring makes the door close, but the damper makes the door close slowly and smoothly. So they have different roles. Elasticity, in other words, the spring part of our tissues, because our tissues are springs and dampers, the spring part of our tissue determines what we would call the resting length of a muscle. What if I just relax, what length does the muscle go to? It's going to go to its neutral position or its resting length, and all of our tissues will do that. But it's the stiffness of the spring and the viscosity of the tissue that determine how quickly they will go to that position when unloaded or how quickly they will stretch when we load them with stretching. So what? Well, we're going to see how this can hurt us in just a minute. One of the things I want to cover off for a second for the non-math inclined is the notion of what's called first-order response, which is how viscoelastics behave. And all of our tissues are viscoelastic. So our ligaments, our bones, cartilage, muscles, everything is viscoelastic. So a viscoelastic is going to behave like a slow motion spring. And the question of how quickly it goes to the position you're trying to stretch it to or goes back to its original position depends on stiffness and viscosity. Now, what we're calling a first order response behaves as follows. And a lot of nature's like this. This is how things kind of slow down and behave smoothly so the door doesn't slam. It closes quickly at first and then slowly, slowly, slowly. The closer it gets to the finish line where the door is closed, the slower it goes. And that's true of any process where the rate of the process slows down as it gets close to the finish line. That's called a first order process. When you have a first order process, you can characterize its rate by what's called a half-life or a time constant. And that means that if we said this is 100% of how far we're going to stretch a tissue, and we look at how long it takes us to stretch it halfway, we'll call that one half-life. Now, if we keep stretching for the same amount of time again, it's not going to go all the way to the finish line. It's only going to go halfway to the finish line. So in the second half-life of stretching, it'll go to the 75% point. And in the third half-life of stretching, it'll go halfway from there to the finish line, so to 87.5. And in the fourth half-life of stretching, it'll go halfway from there to the finish line. In theory, it'll never get to the finish line because as it gets closer, it slows down. And mathematicians would say that it's approaching the finish line asymptotically. That's how it happens. So we would characterize a particular viscoelastic by its half-life. That is to say, how quickly it responds. And when we do that to our tissues, suppose this was my muscle and I stretched it and left it stretched for a long time, it would slowly get longer based on its viscosity and stiffness, and we call that creep. Okay, so it's called creep when a structure is stretched for a long time. Now, we see creep when people stretch in different ways. Suppose I'm stretching my hamstrings badly, but suppose I try, and I've got my leg up on the table here and I bend forward at the hip to stretch my hamstrings. If I allow the weight of my body just to sit here and I don't have a coach pushing on me and I don't do anything else, then the amount of force on my hamstrings is constant and I'm just kind of camping here.
And what will happen if I stay here for a long time is that I'll slowly bend forward as my hamstrings creep and grow longer. Won't happen instantly. I have to stay in that position for a fair bit of time if I want my hamstrings to lengthen maximally. I'm not at this point saying whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to stretch our tissues long enough that they creep toward their limit in length. I'm just saying it is. Okay, this happens when we stretch our tissues. An eminent spine biomechanist from Waterloo, Ontario, Stuart McGill, did an experiment in 1992 with one of his students named Brown, in which they measured the rate of creep in the human spine, the lower back, in people that were alive. They weren't using cadavers. These were healthy volunteer student subjects. And what they did, they had the students, they measured with a special device on their back that measures range of motion called an inclinometer. They had them bend forward and try to touch their toes, and they measured how far they could bend, and then they sat them down. And they sat them down and they asked them to slouch. So they slouched in the worst possible posture for a minute, and then they stood up and measured their range of motion again. Then they slouched for another minute, then they measured their range again, and they kept doing that for 20 minutes. And lo and behold, as the 20 minutes went on, people could bend further and further forward because their tissues were creeping or gradually elongating. They showed that women were more flexible than men, no big surprise, but both the women and men showed first-order creep. And in fact, they fitted the curves mathematically and showed that in both women and men, over a period of 20 minutes of slouching, they gained about 5.5 degrees of forward bending. So the men started with 60 degrees of forward bending and got to 65. The women started with a bit more and got a little bit further, but both sexes crept about 5 or 6 degrees in 20 minutes. And this matches a first-order equation with a time constant of about 9.5 minutes quite well. So what they did effectively was that they showed the creep half-life of lumbar tissues is about 9.5 minutes. Well, if you're doing the math with me, that means if you want to stretch it all the way to its limit, you're going to have to go 5 or 6 half-lives to get up into the 95 to 100% range. And that's going to take you about, well, not quite an hour, 45 minutes to an hour. Okay? They only had the people slouch for 20 minutes. If they'd slouched for 45 minutes, they would have seen the rate of creep slow down more and more. Well, after the 20 minutes, which is enough punishment for these people, slouching for that long, they let them stand up. And they measured how far they could bend forward. And they walked around and stood up, and they kept measuring how far. And sure enough, the tissue went back to exactly where it came from. So an hour or so later, none of these people had gained any range of motion. There's no gain in flexibility that's sustained. In fact, the gain in flexibility lasts a little bit less time than it took to get it. So it took 20 minutes of stretching to gain a certain amount of flexibility. It took less than 20 minutes to lose it. Okay? The actual bottom line of this experiment came with a change in international airports. Stu was hired as a consultant to the Greater Toronto Airport Authority when they were building, I'm not sure which terminal it was, what's now called 3 or whatever, because airports have a problem with people herniating discs. They take 2 or 3 people out of Pearson every day on a board with a freshly injured back, because sitting is bad for your back, which we're going to come back to in a minute. And they asked Stu, how can we reduce the carnage here at the airport? And he said, put the luggage rack at the opposite end of the airport from the gate that the people get off the airplane at. Make them walk for 5 minutes. The worst thing they can possibly do is get off a 6-hour transatlantic flight where they've been sitting in a slouch posture, get up, bend over, and pick up a heavy suitcase right away. Not good for you. But if they walk for just 5 minutes, about 70% of the creep is restored, and because the creep actually restores a little bit faster, and boom, they're good to go after just a few minutes of walking. So I tell my students in my 2-hour classes, I give them a break halfway through. And if they don't get up, I give them heck. Because it's like, no, the purpose of the break is to give your back a break. It's bad to sit in one position for more than half an hour or 40 minutes because your tissue creeps. You don't want to do that. You want to sit up straight. You want to allow the creep to restore. So either sit up straight or stand up. When we stretch, we want to think about which way we're moving joints and what we're stretching, what we're doing with a particular joint. And when, no matter which direction we stretch a joint in, we can measure how much force it takes to stretch. Now, if I'm stretching, say, my forearm muscles, it's really easy to move my hand at first, and only when I get to the end of the stretch does it stiffen up. Remember the meaning of the word stiffness. It takes more force for me to stretch it now than it does in here. In here, it moves really easily, and then all of a sudden it takes more force. We call those the boundaries of motion, and in the boundaries of motion, the load deformation curve stiffens up. It takes more force to bend something. And when we say we're stretching, that's what we're doing. We're taking the joint through the part of its movement that is easy and getting to the hard part at the end where you have to push harder to make it move further. Well, when you do that, what you're now stretching is not the joint per se, but the various tissues that stop the joint from moving. Ligaments or muscles or fascia or cartilage or whatever it is that's constraining the joint movement. We differentiate how far a joint will move, which we call its range, just like we talked about the range of a spring, from how far it moves in directions it's not supposed to move. So the range of movement of a knee, we'll talk about, say, 135 degrees of flexion. My knee can go from straight to this flexed. But if we were talking about how much it bends sideways, we wouldn't call that the range of motion. We would call that joint play or laxity. And that leads us to a couple of our final definitions, and then we'll talk about evidence, that flexibility is defined as the range of a joint. And its flexibility is its range. It is said to be flexible if it has greater than normal or greater than average range. So a flexible joint has greater than average range. That's not the same as if the joint has greater than average joint play. That we will call unstable. But a joint is flexible if it has greater than average range of motion, and a person is flexible if most of their joints are flexible. Because you could be like me. I have a couple of flexible joints. My ankle's flexible, but I wouldn't call myself a flexible person overall. And I want to get rid of one common confusion here. When someone is inflexible, it's not because they are stiff. Okay? It's because whatever is constraining the motion of their joint that's reducing their range of motion is too short. Right? If something is too short, if it doesn't have enough range, it won't stretch enough before it reaches its limit, that will prevent the joint from bending further. Stiffness is different. Stiffness isn't the question of how far the joint will bend. It's the question of how much force or moment it takes to bend it. So those are different things, and we don't want to be confused by them. As an example, we take a hamstrung person like myself, okay, where I cannot touch my toes without bending my spine because my hamstrings are now at the end of their range. Are my hamstrings short or stiff? They're short. Okay, my short hamstrings prevent me from bending farther forward. We've got all these tools now. We can talk about stiffness, range, viscosity, etc. What happens when you stretch something? Well, in the short term, when you stretch a tissue, it gets viscoelastically deformed and then goes back to its original length. So it doesn't change length. All right? There is no change in length. And people have done these experiments ad nauseum. You stretch a tissue and then measure its length based on its stiffness. So you map out its load deformation curve, and it doesn't change one iota. So there's myth number one, that stretching once increases the length of a structure. No, it doesn't. Okay? It doesn't change its stiffness either. You can stretch it as much as you want. It's not going to take how much force it takes to move it through a certain unit of motion. There are no observed changes in stiffness or viscosity with stretching. And it temporarily reduces the amount of force that a muscle can generate, particularly if the stretch is held for a prolonged period of time. This doesn't happen with 5-second stretches, but with 20 to 60-second stretches, there's a temporary reduction in the muscle's strength and power. So that's not necessarily something you want. If you stretch for the long term, though, if you stretch every day for weeks and months and years, then it does start to have some effects. We don't see them in the short term. In the long term, with regular stretching, and it's not good enough to do it once a month or something, but if you do it on a regular basis for a long period of time, then gradually the muscle grows longer. Okay? You get an increased length of muscle. And in specific terms, it's the muscle part of the muscle that's lengthening, not the tendon. So we've observed what are called sarcomeres, little units of muscle fibers, being added in series. and the brown, meaty part of the muscle will grow longer in response to chronic stretching. It doesn't get less stiff. So here we go with the stiffness again. I'm going here, oh, my muscle's stiff, I'm going to stretch it. Why? Stretching doesn't change stiffness. Stretching changes length, but only if you do it repeatedly and regularly over a long period of time. And there are changes in force and power production in the regularly stretched muscle that are related to the change in length. Because as any muscle physiologist will tell you, how strong a muscle is depends on where the muscle is in its range of motion. So if you change the range of a muscle, you're changing the sweet spot at which it generates the most force. That's not necessarily a good thing. I recently saw some fitness testing results from our national cycling team, and someone who had assessed them wrote down that they all had, God help me, tight hip flexors. Okay, so pet peeve number one, their hip flexors weren't tight. Pet peeve number two, for a cyclist, they should be short, okay, these short hip flexors. When you cycle, you don't stretch your leg out into a position where your hip is extended and your knee is flexed. You don't want to have a long rectus femoris quadricep muscle because then it can't generate the right amount of power. So a runner and a cyclist shouldn't have the same flexibility profile. And, you know, it can be optimized for different performances. That's a very technical question that a biomechanist would look at. What is the optimal range of motion for power generation based on the specific task that someone wants to accomplish? You can't say generally, oh, you should stretch it out, it should be longer. The other thing that stretching does is it reduces the amount of discomfort that's felt, and this happens in the short term. So when you stretch somebody's hamstrings, for example, and then measure whether they've grown longer, what you find is they haven't grown longer based on how much force it takes to move them. They show the same load deformation or stiffness profile, but they let you go further. The person doesn't feel discomfort. So they allow you to stretch closer to their limit where they're actually going to start hurting their tissues. Well, that's interesting. Is that good or bad? Well, I'm not sure. It certainly lets them take their joints through a range that they wouldn't go through without having stretched, because now they don't feel the stretch. But it's not necessarily a highly protective mechanism, and I think it's unclear whether that's a desirable thing or not. So, if we want to design a stretching program for somebody, we have to think about a whole bunch of variables, some of which I've already alluded to. How much force do you put on? What direction do you stretch it in? How long do you hold it for? How frequently do you repeat it? How long do you allow the tissue to recover for in between stretches? Is it creeping and restoring, or are you stretching on top of creep and getting cumulative deformation? So those are all loading variables, but there are also anatomical variables, like what are you stretching? And this is one of the things that, in terms of myths and misconceptions, you walk into a gym and ask somebody, what are you stretching? And about half the time, whatever they name, they're probably wrong. Unfortunately, that occurs even with professionals. Even with physical educators, coaches, personal trainers, doctors, therapists, chiros, sometimes people don't have the thinking cap on and they're not thinking. So this question of what are you stretching is possibly one of the most important questions. And the reason that's important is because our body's made of multiple joints. Some of our muscles, like latissimus dorsi, which starts at my sacrum and goes up to my humerus, crosses about 35 joints. So for me to stretch it, I have to simultaneously reposition 35 joints to stretch this one muscle, because it's a 35-joint muscle. Other muscles or structures cross a single joint, and I can stretch them just by repositioning one joint. Some muscles or structures cross two joints, and I need to reposition two joints. But people sort of go willy-nilly all over the place and assume various pretzel postures involving multiple segments of their body, and may not understand what it is they're stretching. They may not know what they're targeting, or if they know, they think they know what they're targeting, they may not be getting their target. We get some surprising results. The first thing to demonstrate, and I've brought this highly elegant model made of 2x4s, this is actually meant to represent two segments in a body. So I have two consecutive joints where the wood can bend in between these joints. And I've got springs crossing these joints. Now, one spring here is long and crosses two joints. And then these two springs are short and each cross just one joint. This is very analogous to the shoulder. The shoulder has a couple of bones involved. I'm missing one of them here. Here we go. A shoulder blade and an arm bone. And when I want to stretch my shoulder back, I can move it at one of two joints or both. I can either move the joint in between my collarbone and my shoulder blade, which makes the shoulder blade move around, this one here, in between the collarbone and the sternum, sorry, this joint, the sternoclavicular joint, or I can move the ball and socket joint. I could hold my shoulder blade still and just move my arm. So I have a choice to make when I want to stretch my shoulder. Which joint am I going to move and how much? If I just hang through a doorway, kind of willy-nilly, or my pal on the pool deck grabs my arm and pulls it back, and I'm not focusing on what's happening, which segment is going to stretch first is my question. Typically, it will not be the one that you want. In the case of the shoulder, the typical problem is that a muscle in here called pec minor is too short and too stiff. So it's a short, stiff muscle. And then the next joint has ligaments that are really long and loosey-goosey and not stiff. And so in this model, this little short, stiff muscle here would be pec minor, and this would be the shoulder joint. Well, if I just grab my arm and bend it, which one is going to bend first, the stiff joint or the not stiff joint? The not stiff joint. That's not the one you want to stretch, folks. Okay? If my target is to stretch pec minor, I need to bend it there, not here. So in order to do that, I'm not going to use the long lever of my arm. I don't want to grab my arm and bend it back. I'm going to stretch the wrong structure. I need to stabilize this joint, stop it from moving, and move my shoulder blade back. So we'll come back to that example in a second. But this is the notion of what are you stretching. And the other thing that happens when you position multiple segments isn't just that you sometimes stretch the wrong muscles. You stretch all kinds of funny stuff. So here's someone stretching her hamstrings. To stretch the hamstrings, which are a two-segment muscle from the butt to the back of the knee, I need to flex my hip and extend my knee. Just like that, okay. But notice her toes are pointing down. That's okay. The hamstrings aren't attached to your heel. You don't need to pull your foot up to stretch your hamstrings, folks. They're attached to the back of your calf here, the back of your leg. So here she's stretching her hamstrings. Her back is straight. The hip is bent. Her knee's straight. The toe is pointing down. That's a fine hamstring stretch. Now she's pulled her toes up. Well, now it isn't her hamstrings that are going to limit how far she can go. They are no longer the range-limiting structure. Now she's stretching her sciatic nerve. And it's the length of her nerve that will determine how far forward she can stretch in that position because her foot is pulled up. Why? Because the nerve goes behind the ankle and she's stretching it now. The hamstrings don't. So she's changed what the rate-limiting or the range-limiting stretching factor is. And if she bends forward here as well, which is my old football stretch in which I hurt my back and felt my disc pop one day stretching my hamstrings, now she's stretching her lumbar spine as well as her nervous system and all kinds of things. Okay? So you get some surprising results when you assume these complicated multi-joint postures. So when should we stretch? Well, let's get rid of one myth right here. The evidence for stretching before activity is poor at best. There is some contradictory evidence. There's some studies that show slight improvements in performance or slight reduction in injury, but pre-activity stretching is generally dubious. We may come back to that. And then techniques of stretching. Should I stretch my hamstrings using my own quadricep muscle, or should I use gravity? Should I let someone else do it? Should I let a trainer or a coach lift my leg up, or should I do it with my own muscles? How much force should I put on? How quickly should I do it? How long should I do it for? We don't know. It's the bottom line. We do not know the optimal dosage of stretching. It's too complicated, unfortunately. People have not done systematic research that checks all of these variables. That would be a very big experiment. You got 20, 30 variables up there when you start bringing people's age and sex and past conditions and which joints are being stretched and so on and so forth. That's one big, huge experiment that hasn't been done. So does stretching improve health or performance? I don't know. First of all, let's ask the question, does it improve flexibility? And the answer is generally yes, as I said, as long as you stretch regularly, frequently, and since we don't know the optimum dosage, we go to the gymnastics gym or the diving pool or the figure skating arena and we look anecdotally, what do the athletes who are very flexible do? And we see that they stretch very frequently and regularly. They repeat it. They tend to hold it for significant periods of time and they do it over and over and over again. And they do develop flexibility. This happens very quickly in children. A stretching program will show marked increases in flexibility within a few weeks, but in an adult, it takes months. So, you know, don't get discouraged if you're trying to lengthen your hamstrings and it doesn't happen overnight. The question of whether stretching can injure you is a question that's different for each joint in the body, but we know that for some joints, like the shoulder that I just gave as an example, it can. So bad stretching can actually induce joint laxity and hurt you. Contrary to the myth that stretching prevents injuries, some stretching can cause injuries. Does it improve performance? Lots of studies have looked at that, and the answer is yes, if and only if a particular range of motion is required for a particular type of performance. So a thrower or a volleyball hitter who needs to be able to wind up their arm needs more shoulder flexibility, because if they can't get their arm back, they can't get any speed on the ball throwing it. A runner who's stepping over hurdles or running needs to have hamstring flexibility to get long stride length. A gymnast or a diver or a figure skater who are judged based on their line need to have that flexibility for performance. But that's not a health issue. Those are performance issues. One of the things, and I'm just about finished, but one of the themes today has been that there's no blanket answer. There's no blanket prescription for stretching. There's nothing I can say that's true across the body. And the story on stretching, whether it's good or bad, and how you should do it, really is segmentally specific and is prescribed on a joint-by-joint basis and a sport-by-sport or person-by-person basis. So it's very specific. We have different segments in the body, like the hip, that tend to become restricted as people get older. So we could give a blanket prescription for hip stretching, pretty much. The calf also tends to unidirectional restriction, so we can give a blanket prescription for stretching the calf. But we don't want to be giving blanket prescriptions for stretching the back or the shoulder, folks. Okay? People hurt themselves stretching those joints. Those joints tend to instability. So what are the bottom lines here? Some stretching is good, some is bad. Big surprise. Of all the stretches you can do, the one that's most likely to hurt you is the slow death, the prolonged posture. You don't even think of it as a stretch, but right now sitting here in front of me, you're stretching your backs. And that stretch of your back, because it lasts 45 minutes, is a more dangerous stretch than bending over and touching your toes at any other time of day when you think you're stretching your back. Staying still is bad for you, and staying still generally involves stretching one or more tissues. Second point about some is good, some is bad, technique is critical. So I can't say stretching the shoulder is bad, but I can sure say stretching like that is bad. Stretching like that is good. Okay, it's a question of what am I stretching at the shoulder? Which segment am I getting? Should you stretch before exercise? Yeah, probably not. It's not a big deal. Good luck changing the culture of sport, though. I've tried with so many teams, they don't listen to me. But, you know, the evidence says that it's better to warm up, which means move slowly. Gradually increase your power and how many calories you're burning. Stretching doesn't need to be part of that, and it may cause problems. So stretch at a different time of day if you're trying to become flexible. If you're going to work on that short calf, those short hamstrings, set aside 20 minutes to have a stretching workout where that's what you're doing, and you're concentrating on your technique and doing it well and doing it separately from other activities. Do prolonged and repeated regularly stretches, and we think that's the best way to do it. And last but not least, on this question of stretching multiple joints at once with assorted pretzel postures, I actually believe, despite there being no really good evidence to support this statement, that it's a really good thing to do. My anecdotal experience is that as people get older, their nervous systems and blood vessels shorten. And these long, multi-segmental structures, like their nerves and their blood vessels, start to restrict their mobility and flexibility. And I think if we don't tell our bodies on a regular basis, psst, we want you to be able to move this way, they'll stop moving that way. Our bodies will lose their ability to go through the range of motion that we want them to go through. But there are two types of problems you get into. One is that you can cause injuries because you're bending the wrong segment. Remember my little model here. I don't want to stretch that spring. I want to stretch that spring. So what do I need to do if I've got a situation like that, which is what occurs at the shoulder and what occurs at the back and hip? Where the back is more flexible than the hip, I go to stretch my hip and instead I stretch my back. I'm getting the wrong segment. So what we want to do is we want to target the short segment, make sure that we're getting at the segment we want by protecting the segment beside it that can be injured. Protect your shoulder ligaments when you stretch your chest. Protect your low back when you stretch your hips. And obviously some education, some anatomy, some help from someone that knows what they're doing is important. So that's where well-educated personal trainers, physical educators, coaches, therapists, and doctors come in. So thanks very much for coming out today. I appreciate you listening.